Thank you very much. It's a real delight and pleasure for me to be here with you tonight. I have to echo what my wonderful colleague, Ambassador Johnson Cook, said. We've really enjoyed sort of traveling the world together and really partnering on these issues of religious freedom that we both feel so passionately about. I have to say that I also am wearing my own clothes tonight, Professor Ferrari, but there is something I would like to borrow from you. I had the misfortune, you might say, of falling in love with a really marvelous man, my husband, with a very unfortunate last name of Sweat. And for many, many years, I have longed, you know, to add just one E to that name so that I could be Katrina Lantos Sweet. And, you know, I do periodically experience last name envy, but I must say, I really envy your last name. So I hope for the balance of this evening that you will all think of me as Katrina Lantos Ferrari. And I am going to think about that myself. I want to thank Cole Durham for graciously inviting me to address you this evening as we mark the opening of Brigham Young's 19th annual International Law and Religion Symposium. And that's really an extraordinarily impressive achievement in and of itself. I also want to thank Cole for being such a good friend and supporter of the work of the commission on which I serve for so many years. As I stand before you tonight, I feel honored indeed. I feel honored to address such an illustrious group of people who have come here from across the globe, men and women who are dedicated to religious freedom. I am also honored to serve as chair of a vital organization which supports this precious freedom around the world wherever it is endangered. I think that tonight I want to talk to you about religious freedom, both from the perspective of the commission that I chair, and also from the perspective of how faith and religion can impact on the character of the societies we build. I think it is critically important to note at the outset that the work we are engaged in, namely the defense of freedom of conscience and belief, is no mere sideline issue. A quick glance across the world, from the Middle East to Africa, from Russia to China, makes it abundantly clear that many of the most vexing and dangerous issues confronting our world stem from a failure on the part of countries and cultures to fully and equally protect this vital right and its essential companion and antecedent, namely the right of free expression. On these twin pillars, freedom of belief and freedom of expression, rest the resolution of so many of the conflicts that have driven and riven our world. It is really important that we get this right. And I hope that this realization will imbue this entire symposium with a sense of great purpose. Today, there are three inescapable facts that serve as a starting point for any discussion about religious freedom. First, across the globe, religion matters. From worship to prayer, births to funerals, weddings to holy days, almsgiving to thanksgiving, for billions of people, religion remains an inescapable source of identity, meaning, and purpose. Second, because religion matters, so does religious freedom. Simply stated, people want the freedom to practice the religion they cherish without interference. Third, in too many countries, the very freedom people want is being denied. According to a Pew Research study released in August of this year, 75%, think about that for a minute, 75% of the world's population, over 5 billion people, live in countries that perpetrate or tolerate serious religious freedom violations. These violations can range from onerous rules and regulations to imprisonment, torture, and even mass murder. Abuses of religious freedom must never go unchallenged. And this is not just the opinion of the United States or a reflection of our First Amendment. It's a fundamental premise of international human rights law. In 1948, as has previously been mentioned, the world community created and adopted the landmark Universal Declaration of Human Rights, including Article 18, which states the following about freedom of religion or belief. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief, and freedom, either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. It's a breathtaking and a profound summation of what we are all about. Since 1966, the governments of 167 countries have signed the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, a binding treaty with protections similar to Article 18, which I just quoted. Nations around the world also affirm the 1981 Declaration on Religious Intolerance and other instruments confirming religious freedom as a fundamental liberty. As an independent, bipartisan U.S. federal government commission, USERF, the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, is firmly committed to the human rights standards found in these documents. It is committed to defending the right of people everywhere to think as they please, believe or not believe as their conscience leads, and live out their convictions openly and peacefully. Clearly, religious freedom is a pivotal right that must be defended. Countries that honor and protect this right are more peaceful, stable, and prosperous than those that do not. Nations that trample on this right provide fertile ground for poverty and insecurity, war and terror, violent radical movements and activities. Thus, taking a stand for religious freedom is not just a legal or a moral duty, but a practical necessity, one that is critical to the well-being of the entire world. As a key part of its mandate, USERF monitors religious freedom worldwide and makes policy recommendations to the President, the Secretary of State, and to Congress. Based on our monitoring of religious freedom conditions globally, we have found that there are at least three kinds of violations engaged in or allowed by nations and their governments. First, there is state hostility toward religion, religious communities, and religious leadership. Second, there is state sponsorship of violent, extremist religious ideology and education. And third, there is state failure to prevent and punish religious freedom violations. State hostility involves actively persecuting people or groups on account of their beliefs. State sponsorship means actively promoting, including exporting, religious ideas and propaganda, often of a violent extremist nature, that include calls to violate the religious freedom of others. And state failure means neglecting to take action to protect people whom others are targeting due to their beliefs, creating a climate of impunity in which religious dissenters are threatened, intimidated, or even murdered. When it comes to state hostility towards religion, two of the world's worst persecutors are the governments of Iran and China. In Iran, a theocratic government has executed people for, quote, waging war against God, while relentlessly targeting reformers among the Shia Muslim majority, as well as religious minorities, including Sunni, Sufi Muslims, Baha'is, Christians, and also stirring up anti-Semitism by promoting Holocaust denial. In China, the world's most populous nation, a communist government ruthlessly suppresses disfavored religious groups, from Tibetan Buddhists to Uyghur Muslims, and from the Falun Gong to the Protestant House Church movement, and Catholics who resist government control of the church. Regarding the category of state sponsorship of radical ideology which targets the religious freedom of others, Saudi Arabia's autocratic monarchy continues to export its own extremist interpretation of Sunni Islam through textbooks and other literature which teach hatred and even violence toward other religious groups. Extremist references that devalue the other are also found in educational materials and textbooks in Iran and Pakistan. Regarding state failure to protect religious freedom, the actions of the governments of Egypt and Pakistan exemplify those of nations which do not protect their citizens against religiously related violence. In Egypt, since the fall of Hosni Mubarak, the government has continued to tolerate widespread abuses against religious minorities, including Coptic Orthodox and other Christians, as well as Baha'is, Shia, Muslims, and dissident Sunni Muslims. It has failed to take adequate steps to bring the perpetrators of violence to justice or to respond to virulent anti-Semitism in state-controlled media. In Pakistan, the government's long-time failure to protect religious freedom was on brutal display earlier last year with the assassinations of Salman Taseer, a Muslim who was governor of Punjab province, and Shahbaz Bhatti, a Christian who was Pakistan's minister for minority affairs and a long-time religious freedom advocate. Both officials were killed for opposing Pakistan's draconian blasphemy law, which is used against Muslims and non-Muslims alike. Clearly, impunity remains one of the world's most serious and growing religious freedom obstacles. From Nigeria to Iraq to Indonesia, there have been extremely concerning incidents of religiously related violence which are not being addressed by investigations, trials, or punishments. It was in response to religious freedom abuses that in 1998, Congress passed the International Religious Freedom Act, or IRFA, which mandated the creation of USIRF, as well as the International Religious Freedom Office in the U.S. Department of State, which is headed by my friend and colleague. So what do we do as an organization in pursuing this mission? How do we operate in defense of freedom or religion or belief? Because Congress has structured USIRF as an independent, bipartisan body, our commission has the capacity to speak candidly and to press openly for a robust response from our government on religious freedom abroad. I sometimes say that we have more running room than some of our colleagues, either in the Congress or in the administration or the State Department, because we're sort of in our own little world. We're independent, we're bipartisan, and we really, in some senses, answer only to our legislative mission. And so it enables us to have sort of a voice that is sometimes a little more candid, a little more robust, and we don't need to do quite so much weighing of the consequences. We can be that clarion call, and we try to do that. To do this work, we work in concert with human rights and religious freedom advocates everywhere, including members of Congress, the executive branch, members of academia, and leaders in religion and civil society. The Commission gathers information both at home and abroad, issues annual reports to Congress and the executive branch, and works with congressional offices on critical issues. It advises and works closely with White House and State Department officials and participates in multilateral meetings with the EU and the OSCE. Each year, along with its annual report, USIRF provides policy recommendations to the U.S. government. The Act requires the President, who has delegated this function to the Secretary of State, to designate countries of particular concern, or CPCs. These are those nations that engage in or permit systematic, ongoing, and egregious religious freedom violations. IRFA obligates the U.S. to take specific actions to encourage CPC countries to honor religious freedom and related rights, first through persuasion, but later through tougher measures if persuasion fails. In our judgment, nations we recommend for CPC status are the world's worst violators, but there are other nations that, while being unmistakable violators, don't quite meet the CPC threshold. These are countries that comprise our watch list, and we also provide recommendations to the U.S. government on how to deal with these nations as well. Over the years, USERF has had numerous successes in advancing the cause of religious freedom. First and foremost, through our unceasing vigilance and advocacy, we have done much to raise the profile of religious freedom as a central goal of American foreign policy. Working with federal agencies, the Commission has collaborated, shared information, and provided advice on matters relating to freedom of religion. And working with Congress, we've seen our recommendations and findings incorporated into dozens of bills and resolutions over the years. You know, I know that the hour is growing late, and you have been a very, very patient audience, and some of the other examples I was intending to share of the specific work of USERF have been ably covered by my colleague. And so I think I'm going to, if I may, with your permission, Cole, sort of jump ahead in a way to my conclusion. I began my remarks by saying that I wanted to address freedom of religion from the perspective of how faith and religion can impact on the character of the societies we build. I would like to close my remarks tonight with a story that I think illustrates this. One of the things I do, one of the hats I wear, is as a university professor. And sometimes I'll ask a classroom of students if they can identify the source of a particular very famous quotation in American political history. And I'll say to them, does anybody know from whence comes the quote, government of the people, by the people, and for the people? Our friends from abroad and overseas may not be as familiar with it, but to most Americans it rings a bell. And when I pose the question, immediately hands from those eager students, you know, anxious to earn those brownie points and to demonstrate their competence, go waving in the air. And I'll always call on somebody and they say, well, of course, Professor Sweat, that comes from the Gettysburg Address and was uttered by President Lincoln as he solemnly commemorated this battlefield where so many tens of thousands of Americans had been slain. And I say, well, that is, of course, the best known origin of that phrase, but it is not the original origin of that particular powerful and compelling phrase. For that, we need to go back many centuries to the 14th century, to the work of a somewhat renegade Catholic priest at the time by the name of John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe felt he was called to a very particular mission, and that was to translate the Bible from the Latin Vulgate, in which it was presently existent, into the common vernacular of the people. He believed deep in his soul that it was his duty to bring the word of God to ordinary men and women, the man who pushed the plow, the individuals who did the common work of society, so that they might be able to learn of those truths for themselves, not simply as it came to them from the pulpit, not simply as it was depicted in the beautiful stained glass windows that surrounded them in their churches and cathedrals, but that they might have it for themselves. He was persecuted and hounded for undertaking this task, but he finished it. And when it was done, he wrote in the flyleaf, "The translation is complete and shall make possible government of the people, by the people, and for the people." Now, I cannot know for sure what he meant by that, but I believe that what he meant by that is that as individual men and women had the opportunity through the study of sacred texts themselves to gain a vision, to gain a glimpse of who they were, of their inherent dignity as human beings, not only would it transform their inner lives, but in transforming their inner lives and their inner vision of who they were, it would enable them to become a force for transforming the world around them. When we speak, when we fight on behalf of, when we advocate for religious freedom, we are not simply fighting for the right of people within their own lives and within their own hearts to pursue truth as they believe it, to live out their conscience. But I believe we are empowering them to become the kind of people and to become the leaven in the societies in which they live that will enable them to build the communities, the countries, the culture, and the world that we all dream of. Thank you very much, and God bless you.